So first off, questions? Okay, well, what I am going to do here is actually go through how we would think about this. So I'm actually going to fill in these slides as we go. We're going to more or less follow the same pattern that we've been talking about, where we start off, of course, at the very end, what our overall goal is, get closer to the end where we talk about what our specific aims are, discuss what our scientific burden of proof is, talk about the sampling scheme that we're using to answer the question, think about how we're going to summarize the effects, think about the problems that we have to anticipate. Of course, handling missing data, that's a big one. Describe what our primary and secondary analyses are, and then think about where we'll start off on our data analysis, what descriptive statistics we'd look at. So, the overall goal, what is it? I say that's not our overall goal. But it is our overall goal. Step back. Yeah, prevention of Alzheimer's, okay? And truly, is it prevention of Alzheimer's? Or is it prevention of progression of Alzheimer's? Yeah, it all depends upon what you're doing. But that's our overall goal. And the key point to remember this is that prevention aspect will play into some of our decisions. That having been said, what are our specific aims? So now, Karen, our specific aims? There we go. And how would you characterize that ototoxicity question? So we have levels of questions that we ask. So ultimately, you know, in my five questions that we have that I can know how to answer with statistics, this falls in the category of four. But of course, I put category four with 4A, 4B, and 4C. And then even in 4B, I further subdivided it, which tells you where we live most of the time. Right? It's the more and more subdivisions. So the specific aim can be either to detect ototoxicity versus quantify ototoxicity. What do you think? And the issue here is what I will tolerate in borrowing information across things. You know, it's this concept that if I really have to quantify the degree of ototoxicity, I might be very unhappy borrowing information from one frequency to another frequency. You know, if I want to describe this is your amount of hearing loss at each frequency and how it progresses. But if I just want to detect it, then borrowing that information might be all right. So where do you think we are here? We're more detection. I think we're more detection, which gives us, you know, a little bit more latitude. So, while it's nice to quantify things, the idea is, where am I going to put most of my effort?
Well, based on the science of ototoxicity, if you just focus on that would be likely to be affected.
Yes, and no. But yes, I mean, you are right. That certainly when we come down to it, I have to run up against the common belief that if it's ototoxic, it ought to be at high frequencies. But even in their document, you know, they said, but sometimes it's not high frequencies. But, you know, recognizing that that's there, that's going to be the biggest hurdle that we have, that I'm going to, if I find something that occurs only at low frequencies, I'm going to have to be more precise in what I'm saying than I am at, if I chose a typical pattern. And so that's the way I go. I'm a paid skeptic. All the time people come and tell me things that I look at the data and say it's just not true. You know, so that's a thing that I'm always, as people say, this is what it is, I'll say, is that always true? And as soon as they say, well, no, not always, then I say, okay, I have to entertain both. So that's the thing. But you're absolutely correct that since it is to detect ototoxicity, and I do think that that's the correct way to state this, it is to detect ototoxicity. It's not just to detect hearing loss. You know, that by using the word ototoxicity, that's carrying with it a belief that this is the thing that happens rather than the drug causes hearing loss because those people with Alzheimer's are now feeling so good and so alert that they're going to go out on December 11th to the Tractor Tavern and go hear Other Lives, which is a fantastic group that you really ought to go see. So, but that's a different story. But it is a very good band. And in case you really cared, they warmed up for Bon Iver, who, of course, I never heard of, but apparently other people have. But more importantly, they are supporting Radiohead on their American tour, which I think is a pretty big step. But Denver's the closest that tour comes, and it's already sold out. So, okay, no, I'm sorry. Well, yeah, we're back to the feeling so good that they go listen to loud music and they lose their hearing. But that's not what you know, and you can imagine that such things happen. It's real. Okay. Another thing that is tied up in this, and this is a very slight thing. I'm going to say that, you know, that there is a difference between our trying to identify a drug that causes ototoxicity and identify patients who are suffering hearing loss from the drug. Okay, very, very subtle difference there. But if, you know, and so what am I complaining about here? What am I trying to dominate? That's the clinical versus subclinical. I do not like the CTCAE criteria personally. They're too strong criteria to be using in a trial for 1 year of something that you might make people take for 10 years. That if you took those CTCAE criteria, that might be the best way to really make sure that this patient has hearing loss. But I want to detect whether this drug has a tendency to cause hearing loss. I care less about diagnosing each individual patient. So I don't want the burden of proof to be, I have to be sure that this drug caused this ototoxicity because I'm suing the drug manufacturer. That's not the burden of proof at all. The trend towards that, if these patients on average lose an inconsequential amount, 3 decibels on average in 1 year. After 10 years, that might be 30 decibels. That would bother me. So again, this detect a tendency towards this about something I need to worry about versus something to say, no, I'm actually not.
Another question, but along with that, the variation in the measurement is 5 to 10 dB.
Yes.
So then the lowest grade is 15.
Yes.
How do you tease that out? I mean, do you specify your own grade, say, over the measurement variation or precision?
Yeah. And so I, you know, and so as I sat
a DSMD on a similar drug and sitting with an audiologist sitting right next to me who said, but our criteria is 15 UV. I said, again, I'm not trying to diagnose this. I think that's too big a path. And the fact is, I can average those effects, and even though when one person has lost 10 dB, I can't swear up and down that that's just not natural variation in one patient. But if 70% of the patients on one arm had lost 10 dB, and only 30% on the other arm had lost 10 dB, again, patient by patient, I don't know who suffered from the drug, but I know the tendency overall. And so detecting that. Most gradings of toxicity, and particularly the NCI, they're treating people for cancer. So I give you a drug to treat your malignant melanoma that will make you go deaf in 2 years. You're going to be dead then anyway. You know, you have stage 4 malignant melanoma, 1 year is the time that you have. And so the National Cancer Institute downplays the severity of some of these things to say, what's a little deafness if you're still alive? But for prevention, we can't do that. And so, again, that's the thing that while I give you those criteria, and in real life, this is what's handed to you in all of these things, they just say, we're using this criteria because NCI is the one group that really went through and graded toxicities. And so using the standard is there. But you need to step back from them at some point. And I've been in situations with cancer drugs worrying about this where we had to fight with the NCI to say, but this is prevention. We don't want to go by your grades. We just backed off. But it, you can use those criteria to say, these are the sorts of things we're looking at. But maybe we want to relax the 15 dB loss. They look at Tim. Maybe we want to relax demanding that it's averaged over 2 years just to say, we'll look at the overall trends across there. We'll try to gather more information. Okay. So what is the scientific burden of proof? What do we have to prove to someone? So? Yeah, so what is, beyond a reasonable doubt, based on the preponderance of the evidence? I'm being unfair probably, because you may not know that those have legal terms in the United States. to convict somebody of a crime, it has to be beyond a reasonable doubt, whereas to win in the civil court, it only has to be based on the preponderance of evidence. And, you know, this is the same thing. If I want to sue the drug manufacturer, do I need to prove that the drug is ototoxic? The answer is yes. And then do I need to prove that this patient lost it due to the ototoxicity? And unfortunately, too often the answer to that question is also yes. And so it's this idea, it causes ototoxicity in lots of people, but not everybody. So how do we know that you weren't at that concert? And, you know, standing underneath the amplifiers. I unfortunately have a friend who likes to do that. So my question is, at this stage, taking into account what do we want to take into account? What we want to take into account is stage of research. Where are we? Is this the final clinical trial that is telling you, okay, this is established and take this drug whenever you want to lose hearing? No. So an efficacy endpoint. No, we aren't there. And it's not the final amount of research. So do we want to
err on the side of not identifying a problem that might not be there? Or do we want to err on the side of identifying a problem that might be there? Which do you want? I mean, this is a value judgment. This isn't a statistical question. This is, what do you want to do? What do you hope people do? That's usually what we do in safety analyses. We do not want, you know, realizing that statistical methods that we use that says you can never prove equality, but you have to prove a difference. Well, if I just keep on doing a really small study, I can say there's no problem. And you read through things in the paper and analyses people do. And the thing that we sometimes do to try to find efficacy, well, yeah, the treatment didn't work overall, but I first threw out everybody who was taking heparin. And then I threw out everybody who was obese. And then I threw out everybody who was female. And then I threw out everybody who didn't have red hair. And then I threw out, you know, and you get down to this little subgroup and say, and now there's an effect. And it never turns out to be true. Well, it can get the opposite situation when dealing with safety. People will go through and throw out things until their sample size gets so small that now you can't prove that the effect's statistically significant anymore. And that's not the burden of proof. So with a toxicity endpoint, we give a little bit more leeway to describe trends. You still don't say, here, we know this case, but you do want to explore it and describe trends that are there, the precision that you have about them, and then you let it go at that. You know, you don't suppress something just saying p-value is greater than 0.05, there's no problem. You give the estimates, you give the description, you give all of the evidence that's going to be looking at the adjacent frequencies, looking at whether it seems to pattern for ototoxicity, looking at anything else that you can get to there to be able to describe what happens. So the idea is, in this cost of mistakes, and here's the difficult part. Who are you? Are you a shareholder for the company? Well, maybe the cost of the mistake is missing a drug that's safe and beneficial. Or are you just worrying about public health, saying, you know what, if this drug doesn't make it, another one's going to come along and it'll pass. You know, so, and I unfortunately work in public health, and I all too often am sitting in a room full of people who work for the drug companies, and they're saying, but you have to consider this. And I go, I don't, you do. You know, I have to worry about this, and the fact is most new drugs don't work, but they are toxic. And so that's the burden of proof. You know, so we just consider that. So safety versus efficacy. So again, the bottom line here is statistical significance is of diminished importance. It doesn't mean that we don't want it. Certainly, if you demonstrate that you have proven that there's ototoxicity, I care, and I'm going to tell you about it. But if there isn't, I'm going to say, here is what we've seen so far. Keep an eye out for it. But if there's absolutely no evidence, if I've got a pretty precise estimate to say that it's not going down, it's actually gone up in the other group, you know, then I'll also say that. So it's just this idea of you're being just a little bit cautious as we're there. And that gives us just a little bit more latitude to not worry as much about multiple comparisons. Multiple comparisons. Just gives us a little bit more license. And if you think about what we face in clinical trials, when we discover new toxicities, when we discover new things that we've never seen before, how many did we before? You know, we've always got a huge multiple comparison problem. Monitoring a clinical trial, it's not uncommon that I look at 60 pages of lists of adverse events and how many subjects had each one of those. And now granted, you know, I'm counting every rash, you know, dog bites, spider bites. I mean, all of these things show up on those lists too, but so does nausea, vomiting, pulmonary edema, heart attacks, liver failure, you know, so you go looking for those. So this is, you know, I wish statistics could handle this stuff better, but we can't always prove all of these things at first. But then once we start seeing it, the usual pattern is you actually design a study to look at this carefully. So if you have a certain number of patients who show up with myocardial infarction or ST wave or QT prolongation or something like that, you then plan a study to say we're going to get the sample size large enough to be able to detect whether this really occurs, and we're going to measure them more precisely and things like that. Yes?
So are we talking about allowing that when it's greater than 0.5, and if we are, can we quantify that, or just say, well, we don't care if our that when is inflated, we'll just allow it to be 0.5?
So I would err on the following side. I would want to make clear those questions I had beforehand. So I don't want it to be off in the ozone completely. I would still, for whatever reason, just habit if nothing else, tend to present 95% confidence intervals rather than presenting, say, 80% confidence intervals if I decreased my type 1 error. But when I reported p-values, as a reader of that, I would be having this tendency to say my threshold is probably closer to 0.1. Okay. And, again, the multiple comparison issue would be one that I would... We don't have this quarter the methods that I would necessarily use to address all the different frequencies in this. But I can tell you that when I did have those methods at my disposal, I wouldn't waste more than a sentence on those methods. All the rest of it is I present exactly all of the methods that you have the capability to do right now. So I would, after next quarter, have a capability to perform a test that says, is there a statistically significant difference at any frequency after I have adjusted for the multiple comparisons? But I don't expect that to be a real powerful test for a couple of reasons. One is, if the ototoxicity really is only occurring at the highest frequencies and only causing damage at two of those, putting in all of those other ones that don't have any damage will diminish my effect to do it. But I'm not so much believing that any toxicity must occur at the highest frequencies when sometimes it occurs at lowest frequency that I want to ignore it entirely. So it's to be fair when I start saying, if I see some trend in ototoxicity, I'll report all of this. But then I'll say, but I'm certain. And I'll provide that one p-value. But that's not going to stop me from ignoring everything else after that. So I'm just going to report it. And that's the major way I use this, is that I feel free to pre-specify that I would do an analysis at every frequency and present those with a p-value. But, and then leave it up to the reader to say, but what are you going to do? Here's 8 p-values. That's right. So what I really do is I present the objective results with just the p-values, 95% confidence intervals, like I always do. When it comes to the discussion, I'd say, and I found one frequency, the 3,000 hertz frequency, in which the p-value was 0.037. And then in my discussion, I will say, but smack dab in the middle, and I didn't see it at 2,000, and I didn't see it at 5,000. So, adjusting for multiple comparisons, you know, if all I had is at my disposal was one for only, I'd say, and this doesn't match statistical significance out there. So, and then I'd say, but, you know, in terms of knowing, you know, what precision we had, how wide the confidence interval was, If it was real, real wide, still, I'd just say we didn't have the precision to rule out that there was a problem. And so all of that comes into discussion. So I sort of stick to my standards, but what I wouldn't do as much is say my primary endpoint was the 6,000 hertz frequency. You know, I would just say we examined all of these frequencies and then we did or did not adjust for multiple comparisons. In real life, I would have done the Olympus test and reported that, but in my discussion, I would have just said I never imagined it was going to be that big of a difference. Okay? So do not, when you're doing a statistical analysis, do not check common sense at the door. Just don't. Statistics only gets you so far. Okay. So the sampling scheme. What are the pertinent parts of the sampling scheme? What are the buzzwords that you want to? There we go. Okay, and? Okay. Okay. So now, was that ordained? Or is that a result?
No, that was set up as part of how they were going
to actually. So they were going to do it stratified. Okay, so I'll throw that in here. And then I'm going to just put in one disclaimer that if I were analyzing the efficacy, so I'm eventually going to say, you know, things up here for the most part should appear in the abstract. You know, these are words that you should find out how to put them all in one sentence in your abstract somewhere. This is so key as what's there. Now, on the efficacy, the stratification by risk of Alzheimer's, perhaps, is very, very important. But do we believe that that same stratification factor mattered for other toxicity? So, again, it's just that what are you going to cram into there? But otherwise, it would be a very important thing. So, stratified, what else? Placebo-controlled. And?
Double-blind.
Okay, I'm just going to put in the two doses here. But then double-blind is the other thing that I'm really looking for. That matters to me. Audiology, subjectivity, well, the audiology is pretty set. But subjectivity could be fears of going in for more audiology measurements, right? So if this were not blinded, but you told people you might have hearing loss, then the people who were on the treatment might be more prone to tell you, you know, I'm just not hearing things as well as I used to. And they may go in for audiology visits more often. And then what happens if you go in for audiology visits more often? You're more likely to see extreme values. And, you know, so it can build into these sorts of things that would affect your analysis. The fact that it's double-blind makes me relax a little bit. Okay. What other things in the sampling scheme are very, very important? Okay. I actually do like to see that. It takes... You know, five character spaces, you can usually fit that in an abstract. But if you go to four doses, I don't go one to one to one to one. You know, three I do. What else?
Sight.
Pardon?
Sights. Not sights.
Sights? I'm sorry.
Two sites.
Okay, sure. And I'm going to put that up here. A lot of people distrust single site studies. The question is, why do you distrust seeing site studies? Why lots of people want to say, we want to see it at multi-site. I have my beliefs as to why you should do that. Mine is, it's too easy to do a single site study, which means everybody and their fourth cousin is doing one and not publishing all those results, so you get a publication bias. But a major undertaking like a multi-site study is going to be reported regardless. But the single site studies tend to be small, tend to be not as much oversight, things like that. So that's an issue. Never mind the generalizability. What else do we want to talk about? What do we do in the sampling scheme?
Talk about the monitoring.
Okay. Yeah. So the key thing is it's longitudinal. Right? And so what about the monitoring? Yeah, so it's a complicated schedule, okay? So, and I do think that's a, schedule adjusted mid-trial. It's not an entirely unusual thing that this happens, but it does screw us up, right? That does make it harder. In my one, you know, set, I would love to put a bunch of this stuff in. I mean, the beta carotene is so much easier. Yeah, there was to be 3 months of run-in with monthly measurements and during 9 months of treatment and then follow-up. You know, that's real easy. But here, it wasn't, I can't say, monthly measurements or, you know, whatever. And then the schedule didn't go. So you want to summarize somehow what was planned. And I'm not sure I had to know how I'd do it. You know, it'd be nice to say generally having measurements at 6 months and 12 months or 6 weeks and whatever, you know, that you described that. Certainly giving a hint that the schedule was adjusted in mid-trial. They know that they need to go look at the statistical, the material, the methods, and then the statistical methods to see how it was handled. Okay, what else do we want to know? The measures that we have themselves, right? And what do we have? Right. And it doesn't rise to the level of the occasional screw-up, so whether all eight frequencies were measured or not, that doesn't quite rise to my level of importance, but sometimes it might. Anything else really key on this? Okay, now, did we plan to have them, or is that just the problem that came up? So I'm going to, that's, I want to go to that one, which was the anticipated problems. But I'm going to handle that more as we do this. But this is a place where really I want to get a little bit circular. The second that you say longitudinal data to me, I say, and you're going to have dropouts. You know, the longer period that you're supposed to follow people, the more dropouts you're going to have. Do not become complacent in that, however. There have been clinical trials that have been done very well with very high follow-up because people paid attention to it. They did not, you know, they did not have only 80% follow-up. They had 98% follow-up over a 7-year period. It took effort, but they still had some dropout. But Tom Fleming, who's here, is very big on pointing out, he goes, we went and we did a trial in Uganda where there were not addresses that we had to follow up people. They had no set addresses. You were out in the back country and had to follow up people. And he said, we had 95% follow up. Now, if we can do that in those situations, certainly we can do it in downtown Seattle. But too many investigators just say, oh, well, what can we do? It's too hard. And you do that. But still, you plan for that. And so I'm going to come to that in, I think, the next slide after this one. Yes. So, but first, let's just talk about, in summarizing effects, think first about what we would do. Everything goes according to plan. As we summarize these effects, what are the different dimensions that we have to consider? So first, how will you summarize the potential of effects? High-dimensional data dome. We have doses. We have frequencies. We have time. What are we going to do about it? How are we going to summarize it? So I'll just put it in no particular order that we'll address. So we have the summary measures. We have what we're going to do over time, what we're going to do over frequencies, what we're going to do over ear. Now, you know from any data analysis, if you end up with more statistics than you had original observation failed, okay, there should be some summarization that we're doing. And you can't answer everything, so don't try. Instead, decide what's the most important thing for you. So pick one. Let's pick time. That's a good one to start with. What are our choices? How could we handle time? Okay. So change final, well, baseline to final. Okay. Okay. So multiple times. Yeah, multiple times. And on that multiple times, if you're going to look at multiple measurements, you have to think about what's your criteria for those multiple measurements. Sometimes we do designs that we say we're going to have multiple outcomes, and they're called co-primaries. And when we usually use co-primaries, we mean you have to meet all of them. So we would only call it ototoxicity if you had hearing loss at every single time we measure. Or our threshold would be if we identify some time that there will in fact be more. So this is, I'm going to write any versus all, but those are things that we would consider whenever we have multiple endpoints. In this particular thing, it's not as much a question of how we would do that. But certainly when you do run into multiple endpoints in other situations, there's sometimes that the criteria is you must demonstrate the effect has a clinical effect, certain biochemical effects, certain histological effects.
So do you recommend that we, if we're doing multiple times, we define ototoxic if they have journals at any of the times?
I would be more inclined to talk about, and again, when we go back to this slide, the detecting ototoxicity versus quantifying the ototoxicity. That detecting it, and again, we're back to, if we're trying to find a drug that has problems, rather than find out which patients had problems from the drug, then finding that it caused problems at some time during the treatment, later we'd sort out whether we cared about it. But if we couldn't find out it ever had an effect, then why bother sorting out when that effect didn't occur? I mean, that's sort of the, you know, breaking it down into steps makes sense. And so because of that, I would be more inclined to say if I found it at any time. Okay, what else could we have done?
Just the final.
with the idea that a transient effect that went away wasn't being us in the prevention in a long time. That's good. That's good. It didn't lead to any clinical problems during the time they were taking it, and it goes away. Then we're fine.
If you use some patients to follow up and you don't get the final 1 year time point, is it sufficient to just go with the final observation?
Say that again.
If some of your patients drop out and you can't get the 52-week measurement, is it sufficient to...
Okay, I'm going to revisit this with the missing data, but only because there's that question. It depends upon what your question is. It depends upon what your question is. And again, how much of our question is... what's happening to the people who can take this for a year? And how much of our question is this a drug that has the potential to cause ototoxicity? And depending upon, you know, what question I want to answer, if a certain number of people start getting hearing loss, they stop taking the drug, it's completely reversible, there's no lasting level, and the people who continue taking it for a year, maybe I'm still happy with the drug. And I can answer that question about can I proceed to this other testing because the people who do manage to keep taking it are doing fine. But the other level is, do I need to be on alert status because this is a drug with demonstrated capability to affect hearing? That's a different question. And then I want to know about those early people who dropped out because of. And it's hard to get a single statistic that answers both of those questions. So you have to choose. And so we'll come back to that with the missing data. What else could we do, though? I'm going to write this down just because this one's a slight variation on one that's already been said. But I could look at the slope using all times. Okay, so taking the baseline to final, that difference is a slope, right? But I could have used all of the data as well. When is it better to use all of the data? When is it better to use just the final minus the baseline? Okay. Yes, so if we're going to extrapolate from the slope, so we can estimate that slope given the first two measurements and then just imagine the same slope would have occurred, we can do that.
If you think the mechanism for ototoxicity occurs throughout the treatment, then it's longer, it would be better, but you think it's, there's like a threshold time after which you start getting ototoxicity effects, and maybe, you know, it takes time to find
another. That's exactly right. It's sort of... if we knew it was a linear effect, if we knew it was straight line over time, there is just no question. Use all of the data. If it's nonlinear, then I have to watch what I'm going to say. Because if the ototoxicity occurs as a sudden jump right after giving the therapy, the slope that will be estimated would be attenuated from that same effect, but it's still finding. But if everybody just gets the ototoxicity right at 1 year, 5 minutes before you do the audiology, and everybody's deaf, putting in all those measurements at zero for a long time will make the effect look less than what you really care about, which is the final result. So you have to decide, again, what sort of patterns there will be, whether you think it'll have to be a gradual effect, whether it's a step function effect, what do you know about this, just for fun, I will tell you that, you know, you try to then think about the pharmacokinetics of the drug and how fast it's absorbed, how fast it hits steady state, things like that. And on this particular drug, there was certainly some evidence that bizarre things happened way after it hit steady state. So, and at higher doses and things. Y'all didn't know all of that background because I didn't tell y'all about it, but this is the fears about this drug were quite... So you'd have to make those decisions about what you think would happen. And what I've just described is, you know, people at high doses walked in and said, you know, yesterday I could hear, today I can't. But this was after several months of taking the drug, a drug that had a half-life of 12 hours, 15 hours. That sort of thing shouldn't happen if you understand the pharmacokinetics. Obviously, we do. So another thing that we could do with time. Okay, that's the multiple times. I mean, use each one of those individually, compare each one of them individually. What else? Give you a hint. We took differences. So what does that leave? Well, we could... that's going to be the same. Rather than contrasting the effects, we could take the average of it. Okay, now, would we average in the baseline, or would we take that just as the starting point and we do this? But we could average across time. And then this last one, because it is rarely indicated to do, but it is something we could do. We could take a cumulative product of time by hearing loss. So I'll say, how many days worth of 5 decibel loss did you have? Then I'll factor in both time and this. And it's not a time average because it's cumulative. The people who dropped out but had a lot of hearing loss for a month would count the same as somebody who stayed on there for a year with only a tiny bit of hearing loss. This is a bizarre thing to do, but very occasionally we do it. Very occasionally we look at these cumulative effects. Okay. In drugs, and when we're measuring drug exposure, we do it all the time. Smoking, we do it. You know, when looking at exposures, we do this all the time. When looking at outcome, we don't. Okay, so now we have all of these things that we could do. How would we summarize those different things? What are our choices on summarizing? So I could get a single measure for each individual across time, or I could do it at each time. But then I still have to summarize those measurements. What would you use? You talk first, you get the easy ones. The mean, medium. Why not? What else? You could do it, right? Geometric mean. What else? I'm sorry? Proportion. Proportion above a threshold. Okay. And, of course, this means that we know a threshold to use, but we've got suggestions, right? What else could we do? Sure. I'm objecting more to the magnitude of what they were looking for, rather than the idea they were looking for. That, you know, that it's this idea of dichotomizing an outcome at some clinical level, knowing that some of it could be noise. You know, some of it could be just natural variation, but that's okay. The tendency is there. So then we can go one step further. If I do agree to talk about the exceeding some threshold, what else could we look at? Okay, yeah, okay. Or? Pardon? Okay. So this is only possibly, you know, why did I put this here instead of the next one? I can combine them two. Pardon? Ratio? Yeah, okay. Those would all be the same because how I handle ratios is I take the log and I do the difference, but that's okay. I mean, you know, so that's good. So this is a pretty good game of guess what I'm thinking. Time to reaching some threshold. Okay, so this is a way of combining the idea of summarizing the measure and the time. So why did I put it here and not there? I don't know. You know, but you could consider this to say not only are they more likely to hit some threshold, but they're likely to do it earlier and try to capture that. So you could do that. I'm not really recommending it, but there are times that we do such things as saying the reason. Okay, what about frequencies? What would you do? We could use all. Use one. Probably the highest would make the most sense. Okay. We could group them. Yeah. Across some levels. I mean, it's really sort of everything we did with time we could do with frequencies. Because it's ordered in the same sense. You know, we could do it. Again, we could look at a slope. Okay. The slope where we would be trying to detect that there was a difference by frequency. You know, that it's not just earwax, which might affect all frequencies, but that's other toxicity. We could do all of those things. And what about ear? Okay, we can do all of the same thing. Yeah.
So frequencies could be like good as a fit to compare whether the change in distribution is comparable across.
Okay, so I wouldn't call this a goodness of fit, but you could do this omnibus test to look at, you know, what's going on at each frequency. In all of these things, I have some problems. You know, and my problem dealing with some of these is there's information in the frequencies they told me, but it's not so precise information that I know exactly what to do. So they told me, we expect it to show up at the highest frequencies first. Okay, that's good. How much first? If 1 month shows up at the highest frequency, is the next month, is it at the next frequency, or is it a slower process than that? It shows up a lot at the highest frequency and a little bit at the next frequency and even a little less at the next frequency. And, you know, it's what I do with the slopes and things like that. There's so many options there that sometimes I come down to saying, just show me each frequency and I'll, you know, judge that whether the picture looks like that or not qualitatively rather than more quantitatively. But you could do that. And when you first said goodness of fit, I was, you know, I guess my initial reaction was you're checking to see whether the loss is similar across all those frequencies when you think it's a fit. And that's a little bit like going down the slope, but it's, you know, that you're then giving it license to, well, as long as you've lost, yeah, as long as you've gone deaf equally at all frequencies, it's okay. It's just we don't like it if it's not equal. You know, and again, we're just stuck with this thing that there's nothing we can answer with a single statistic that will address all of these possibilities. We're going to have to choose which one we go after. So what about ear? Well, we have all the same things. I guess they aren't ordered, but it really doesn't matter. It's a debate. If you have a binary variable, is it ordered or not? I measure the rightness of my ears, and my left one comes in at 0, and my right ear comes in at 1. The major things we could do here is treat separately. Okay. Average them. There is another thing, but we aren't really covering it this quarter, but you cover next quarter, is treat as replicates. We don't know how to handle correlated data that well, but next quarter you will, certainly at the nuisance level. Just we have two measurements on the individual that mean the same thing to us. We can throw them both into the model and adjust for the correlation. So I'm talking a little bit about that on Friday. I actually thought I'd get to it at the very start of it today about what we do with correlated data. But one thing we do is we go ahead and take the repeat measurements on each individual and we just adjust for the correlation that's there. But you don't have those methods, and it's not clear to me that those methods are any advantage over averaging them. So I'll tell you what I personally would do, but there's a wide variety of things to do. Mine is knowing nothing else, left to my own devices, I go with the mean. If I had a really good threshold to use and I knew what was clinically important at this subclinical level, that's a contradiction in terms, I would take that threshold. But because I am worried about small changes that aren't at some clinical level yet, but that might go there, the mean will be a little bit more sensitive to finding all sorts of bizarre patterns. Time. I'll note that the change baseline to final, or using only the final measurement in a randomized study where the baseline levels should have been the same on average in both groups, both of those are trying to answer the same thing. So in terms of the scientific part, I don't care what you use. When it comes to precision, which I want to talk about in just a moment, then we're going to talk about what to do with the baseline values. So it's a precision question, not a scientific question. By randomization, the difference between the groups in the change or the difference in the groups in the final measurement are estimating the exact same thing. But that doesn't mean they're estimating them with the same precision. So my thing would be either change or final. And I think for the reasons that John brought up is the reasons why I would stay away from the slopes is I'm not 100% comfortable with even how much I care about the interim measurements on people who I have a later final measurement on. But I certainly am not convinced it would be linear, but part of that is driven by not studies that I worked on, but other reports on this particular drug. So, and I didn't really tell you all of that stuff, so you don't do that. The frequencies, I think I would personally rather examine all of them. So I'm going to say examine each. Putting up with the multiple comparisons. This is allowing me the subjective chance of just being able to judge each frequency and then later qualitatively saying, are we seeing any statistical significance patterns that there might be or any trends in the estimates that seem to go with ototoxicity, but I don't yet know enough in this early phase study to know how I expect it to behave. So that would be my opinion. Again, leaving the multiple comparisons, the worst thing I'm doing, particularly if I don't adjust for the multiple comparisons, is running the risk of saying there's a problem too often, not of missing any problem that's there. And if this isn't complicated enough, you know, I don't know what is, so averaging the ears, you know, it's not very much of a gain in simplicity, but if I don't have to look at the right and the left, that's something to say. So this is the sorts of decisions I would make, but pretty much everything's up there I could make an argument for if you pressed me for it. Mike?
What about looking at here the maximum decrease?
Yeah, maximum decrease would also be a thing, but that maximum decrease would be a different issue, and I should include that. I should include that under time. And just note that if you look at that maximum decrease, I'll always be nervous if I don't have equal numbers of measurements on everybody. Okay, but actually, I just need them equal by group. So this change in the frequency, as long as they're balanced by groups, I'm not as bothered there. But the other thing that I'm doing here is I'm committing myself to saying if there were a transient effect and that went away and people tolerated it, I would detect that rather than detecting what's going on at the end. But if I take the final measurement, as we'll come to in anticipating problems, take the final measurement that I have for each individual. That might be during a period of a transient loss if they dropped off the study for other reasons. So I've still got that part, but I'm just guaranteeing that I would be looking at any transient effect.
You're talking about baseline versus low measurements. I was talking about maximum decrease
Oh, okay. Okay, I see. Yes. So that to deal with the right left. Okay, that would also work. So either way we looked at that. I mean, truly, time, frequency, ears, you know, time, space, it's really the same problem. Okay? So anticipating problems, what problems should you anticipate? Isn't that easy? Missing data. And why do people miss data? Adverse events? Okay. Why else?
Death.
Why else? Comorbidities. I like to always, you know, we can't always tell the difference between adverse events and comorbidities, but pregnancy is not an adverse event to me, although it often shows up on the adverse event tables just because that's where they report it. But it's not an adverse event, but it certainly is a, and it's not a comorbidity either, but it certainly is another. Well, I've got this one nephew. No. It's another medical condition, you know, that's not related to the treatment, but it certainly is a contraindication to taking the drug. And sometimes we'll have things that are contraindications to the drugs that are not related to, that we're not at all suspecting is related to the drug itself. What else could there be? What, I sure lost a follow-up. And what else? Lab error? Okay, sure. What else? Yeah, so Alzheimer's. Yeah, so the idea is, yeah, boy.
You wander off because the drug didn't work.
Efficacy. Okay.
Or it does work
in your placebo. Yeah, efficacy. Oh. So I know the joke about wandering off and loss and lab error, but that's a different story. Let's see. Yeah, it's the lab error. You know, somebody called up and said, "Well, you know, we just got your husband's lab results back, but it was mixed up with another patient, so we don't really know whose sample was whose." I said, "Well, what's the problem?" I said, "Well, we know that either your husband has Alzheimer's or he has syphilis." I said, "Well, what do you suggest?" He goes, "Take him to center of town. If he finds his way home, don't sleep with him." So, anyhow. Okay. Yeah. What else? So this efficacy can be lack of efficacy that causes them to stop, or it could be efficacy, that they're now feeling so well that why do I need to do this sort of thing? And depending on your trial, that can show up. Okay? So as I characterize these, and the reason why I think through these is this goes into what I wish I could estimate. And I'll just put that this inconvenience, the people who are inconvenienced by being in my clinical trial, they're clearly bad people. It's not my fault that they should be better. The deaths, well, to me, a death is an adverse event. But it actually, that is not missing data to me. I should define my endpoint that allows for the deaths might occur. You know, how well does a dead person hear? They're completely deaf. Well, I guess it depends upon your belief in contacting dead zombies or whatever. The loss to follow-up, when we do that, yeah, okay, there's bad people involved, but I can't decide whether it's the patient or the investigator. Whose fault is it that they lost them to follow-up? The lab error, truly, if it's absolute lab error, I'm not always worried that, you know, they managed to lose just the values that were this thing. But some of these are reasons that I would not want the patient to keep taking the drug regardless. So it's ridiculous for me to talk about wanting to know what would have happened had they kept taking the drug. And this is my key point. Which of these people, does the data exist out there and it's relevant? And which of these are, the data doesn't exist. It's not relevant. It's not important. The other aspect that falls under this anticipating problems is non-adherence to schedules. So you might have the month four measurement. They called it month four, but it really occurred at month seven. And this can be a problem. That all the times, if you tell a site and patients that we must have these measurements, whenever the patient comes in, there's this question. And it's the rare clinical trial that has done a really good job that has anticipated saying, if a patient has missed this window for the visit, you will call it a missing value, and the next time they come in, it'll be the next visit, not this one. You know, that you have to file those forms and you need to do it. But as a general rule, look at the actual time, the number of days from there, and describe the number of days, not just the number of visits. At the bottom of that file, I told you how to do it in Stata. It's a very easy technique. All you do is you define what the date is, and then you do subtraction. That tells you the number of days. Divide by 30.4 if you want it to be months. Divide by 365.25 if you want it to be years. But you just get those. So this can cause a problem. So then we come to, what is the estimand? What is it that you're wanting to estimate? And the questions that I characterize these days, I only have three questions. I can ask, what is the effect in people who actually will take the drug? What is the likelihood that you will prevent Alzheimer's in people with this drug if they won't take it? Well, we pretty much know the answer. They may not get Alzheimer's, but it's not from the drug. But we could ask, instead of will, the could. This would include those people who we just lost to follow-up, who said the study was inconvenient or whatever. We're imagining that in our clinical trial they refused to take the drug and get measurements. But in real life, if they knew the drug was beneficial, they would take it. I usually don't worry about that group too much because I find that adherence is higher in a clinical trial than it is in real life. You know, you've got people beating on you. We've selected you because you're more likely to come into clinic visits and things like that. So I don't care as much about the second question. But I do care about sometimes what happens to people who start taking the drug. Efficacy type questions, maybe I don't care as much about this if I can reliably separate these out. But if I have people who started taking the drug and they all died, I want to find that out. I don't want to say, oh, well, but those people who died, they aren't still taking the drug after a year, and so it doesn't matter. But if it's just merely people who can't tolerate the drug, but another sizable proportion of the population can, and those people who can't tolerate the drug, I can safely find out that they can't tolerate it, you know, that it doesn't kill them. It just gives them a mild headache, they stop taking it, and that's fine. So these are the hard questions to answer. Which one would you prefer? Judgment call. It's just your personal preference, you know. Mine would be with the toxicity endpoint. I'm going to go a little bit towards I want to find out about a drug that causes toxicity. Just to be knowing that. And then separately, I would answer the question, you know, what are the long-term effects among those people who are taking it? But, you know, starting off, I'd want to identify that. So I'm going to err a little bit on saying I'm going to take the final measurement that I have on each individual. This is an in-between thing. Somebody who has a transient hearing loss, but then it goes away and they're fine and they stay on the drug, I will count them as they're fine. Somebody who has a hearing loss and they drop off the study drug because they have that hearing loss, I'm going to pick that out. And I won't know whether it would have gone away or not. And then somebody who stopped taking the drug due to inconvenience or stopped taking the drug due to a rash, not hearing loss, but during the time of a transient hearing loss, I'm going to pick that up. And that's the breaks. So again, I'm not going to do everything perfectly, but I'm going to err on the side of betting that somebody who had hearing loss at the time they stopped taking the drug, that was the sign that it was ototoxic, you know. And so I'd live with that. So then we have the question also of how do we preserve comparability? The treatment groups. We had randomization. Our group started out being comparable. Some people dropped off. But when I define that I am interested in the outcome at the last time that the person was still taking the drug, then my groups are still comparable. Admittedly, the people in the placebo group who didn't drop out but would have dropped out on the other arm, well, they're really represented. I'm really seeing what would happen to them. So in this case, it's not such a problem. I am not pretending. So there's some people that say last observation carried forward. I am not pretending that the measurement that I have at 3 months on somebody who dropped out of trial is the same measurement that they would have had at a year. I'm instead pretending that if they dropped out at 3 months, I only cared what happened to them at 3 months. If they stayed taking the drug for a year, I cared what happened to them at a year. So this is something that I do with a safe endpoint. This is not something that I do very often with an efficacy endpoint. With a safety endpoint, I'm just saying, I've seen the maximal damage. And sometimes we say, don't take it just at the time they drop out. Take it for, you know, 7 days after, 28 days after they do it, whatever, after they drop off. But it's that concept that the relevant time period that I had to detect a drug that was ototoxic was during the time they were taking the drug. That's not true for cancer. A drug that causes cancer doesn't cause it immediately. You know, you have to think about these mechanisms. But that's the way I would go. So I don't have as big a problem with the comparability of these treatment groups, providing I do have a measurement of the audiology at the time of dropouts. But the ones who drop out and hate you so much that they won't even do the audiology measurement, they're still a problem for me. Okay. So what are the analyses, now that we know what questions we want to answer, plus or minus? How do we actually do these analyses? What are our choices? T-test, why not? Okay, t-test on what? So t-test by dose, or say t-test comparing dose placebo, that's one possibility, on change from baseline, right? And we could do this for each dose. That's one possibility. Okay? I could do a t-test. Just on Nyland measurement. Okay. In fact, as we're talking in discussion section this week, the best way to adjust for baseline in a randomized clinical trial is actually to regress change from baseline or final. It doesn't really matter. Either one of these is the exact same on dose, placebo, and baseline. So adjust for the baseline as a predictor. Okay. If you want to do this, it's really next quarter that you learn about doing this multiple regression. But truly all you do is you say regress, difference, high dose is an indicator of high dose versus placebo, and you throw out the other ones, and then you say baseline. Just type it in there, and it's just like an adjusted t-test. It's basically a t-test adjusted for baseline, and it's more precision. That's the reason why you're doing it. It's more precision. In this data set, I would consider it very bad to do the second one because there's high correlation in this data set between the measurements, and if you don't at least take the difference, you should at least take the difference from baseline. If you don't do that, that's a license to make people go deaf. You just lost too much precision. So you really need to, on a toxicity endpoint, it is very, very bad to do a conservative analysis. You need to do one that has the most precision. So it matters a little bit more. And there's one thing that I tell you I would really do, but it's not a big deal. You know, you're allowed to do any of these things. First and foremost, do something that you know how to do. Do not try to do something fancy and get it wrong. If you try to do something fancy and you get it right, that's A-okay. But boy, if you do something fancy and you get it wrong, that's where most bad statistics is done. So we could regress change from baseline on the continuous dose variable. Don't dichotomize it. Compare both doses at once. And the idea here is, if the drug is causing ototoxicity, we certainly expect it to be worse at higher doses than at middle doses. So why not look for that? So it's not wrong to compare each dose to placebo. I would probably present descriptive statistics of each dose versus placebo, but do a test based on the linear trend. And so all that you would do is rather than creating dummy variables for each dose and then throwing out the dose group that you aren't interested in, you would actually just throw the dose variable in straight out. It might be useful, just to make it easier to talk about it, it might be useful to recode your dose as 0, 1, 2 so that your parameter estimate is the change in hearing level per 0.25 milligrams per dose, rather than if you don't recode it that way, you're talking about the expected change over a dose that you never tested. You didn't test a 1 milligram dose, you tested 0.5. That's your maximum. So that's just a matter of presentation. And all that takes is recoding. Secondary analyses, we asked you another question about what happens at time, over time. One of the simplest approaches is choose some earlier time point and do the exact same analysis. Or the other approach that I might use, be a little bit more prone to use in this one, is like you have for the DLCO data set. Look for the maximum loss over time at each frequency. And that way, if there were just a transient effect, you'd find that. And that would be the difference. So the two major choices would be either repeat above analysis at other time points, possibly just showing it descriptively, showing a plot, or analyze the maximum hearing loss over time for each frequency. Just like you have in this week's homework, you have the minimum DLCO and the final DLCO, which is the way those were real analyses that I did on that data set. And this is real analyses I'd consider in this data set. And the difference between it and their primary analysis is your primary analysis is a little bit more geared towards the long-term effects. This one would pick up transient effects as well. I'm not certain that transient effects are something that we're real scared about. You know, that there's much. There are things that people do lose hearing for a short while and they regain it and then lose it again. But on the whole, it's there. And descriptive statistics. You bet. Exactly. Yes. Exactly the same analysis, but just be using that maximum. There are some issues involved with doing this, as you'd like to know that by treatment arm, you were getting similar numbers of measurements per each individual, for each individual. So it didn't matter, you know, the really bad schedule problems we had were by site, not by treatment arm, you know. And so you'd want to look to see that, you know, does that look sort of reasonable that at any given time, we were seeing that those values approximately comparable. But the other thing is, I might still do that and then just discuss this problem. You know, in the discussion, you say, here's a limitation of my analysis. And so then now you're at the things of, well, what things do you present first so that the readers, by the time they see your analysis, also understand the context of it. And y'all have an easier job than do the beta carotene, because the beta carotene has 5 dose groups and you only have 3. So that means table 1 can fit more of your data. You want to be able to make certain that the readers can know what sorts of people contributed to your study. What was the age range? You know, what were the various measurements? But then you also want to be able to compare the means of all your patient characteristics. Were they the same average age, the same average percentage of male or female? You know, whatever other measure, the same baseline frequencies. You know, how comparable were the treatment groups? And it's going to be the means that matter the most on that. So, mean or median, maybe. Standard deviation range for describing sample characteristics. But mean and standard deviation for assessing comparability of groups. And because I need that part to be the mean, I tend to use the mean for the first part too. So I usually do not report medians. I need to see the mean at some point. And the mean and the median is too much. But I certainly want to know that our patients ranged in age from 20 to 27. No, they didn't. They were, you know, older. Well, you know, you want to know that range of values just to know what sort of patients you have. Then, in a longitudinal study, particularly one prone to loss of follow-up, you want a table to... That is, patient disposition, length of follow-up, exposure to drug, you know, those sorts of things. You want to be able to say, how on average, how many years you have.
What's patient disposition?
That's it. What happened to the patients?
Oh,
this many died, this many wandered away, lost the follow-up. This is, it's just, you're just describing what, and this is a result. They didn't do what you said, so you have to describe what happened in there. And then, table three, and a figure is descriptive statistics about the outcomes. And there's many different ways you can do this, where you would show what the average hearing loss was at each frequency in each dose group. Maybe you would draw plots of the average of it over time, or you put it in a table. It's going to be hard with this scheduling problem, so you may just want to show it at a couple points and maybe not show it as the figure. Maybe just show it as a table, just to say, we're going to take the measurement closest to 6 months for everybody and the measurement closest to 12 months for everybody. Or the closed measurement, and that would be just for the descriptive part. Your analysis would have been the final measurement for everybody. It would be the way I would have done it. And you get to do all of this in 5 pages. Because, as you heard, I stopped reading in 5 pages. But it's really very straightforward. Don't make it complicated. That's actually what happens. It really is what goes wrong in most data analyses. And that is why you're really seeing these two things, is I decided that if you're going to learn how to make simple analyses out of complicated data sets, it might as well start in this order.
In table 3, would we also include the results of the regression?
Yes. I would tend...
For a separate table.
Well, you could do it together, but you could get that 4 columns in there pretty easily as a mean plus or minus, and it might be the standard deviation that you gave for the change from baseline. And then, over on the left, your estimate of the slope of the confidence interval would be
that. If you're giving a mean change from final to baseline, that's your descriptive statistics.
That's
the mean of that. But then, for some reason, you decided to do the regression on just the final measurement.
It has to add it in the same model.
Okay.
They're the exact same model. So the statistical inference would be exactly the same. So you get away with doing that. Lots of fun. But sometimes I even do a regression model that isn't the same as what I just presented. Like I divided age up into 4 groups, but then I fit age continuously over the cyber and I just say, the value of investment in front of the other. All right.
Just for all these things that you switch, just to put up age, and you have to just discuss.
Baseline, after you've adjusted for baseline, you truly have adjusted for all the things that affect hearing. That might be age and sex and things like that, right? So that's the major thing to adjust for. And I just really wouldn't adjust for anything. I have no particular reason. I mean, I do have worries, to tell you the truth, about effect modification only in the following sense. The really old people who are already deaf at certain frequencies, I can't make them deafer. But the other people, I could make deafer, you know? And so that maybe you want to examine by age, I could maybe think of, but it would not be wrong to ignore it completely and save that for another day. You know, sometimes you get so caught up in doing so many analyses that people all sides of the forest for all the trees. Sometimes it's better, you know, the less is more thing answers. One question, and leave really complicated analyses after it's digested and you've brought in information from other studies and things like that. So it's perfectly okay. Defects or the adjusted defects that would be there. Answer your questions. I mean, don't we have enough problems just trying to deal with the time and the frequencies? Do we really have to go out for some groups? It really does get too confusing, and you just can't handle that. So stick to a simple approach.
Can you talk about the length of follow-up, the sensory distribution, and this kind of thing?
So, I'm not sure that we have censoring on the length of follow-up, since basically the people could no longer get the drug when we lost track of them. So we know exactly, even on the loss of follow-up, when they stopped taking their drug. So it's not censored, and just reporting the mean days on drug is adequate. Just simple descriptive statistics on that. And but by dose group, because that would just be interesting. Say, are we seeing that one dose group had much less drug exposure than another? And then also we use that because when I say there was no hearing problem, even at the highest dose group, and they said, yeah, but on average those people only took the drug for a month, you know, then you're saying you know that we have to interpret it in that line. They actually did take it on average. But that's the sort of thing that goes through my head is saying, I have to live with how long they took it, but I need to remember whenever I did not see toxicity that that's all it was. I think that giving that descriptively for what they say probably, you know, unless you're seeing really, really consistent sorts of things, the table would be judged a waste of space and that you could do that in the text. I only partly believe reasons that patients say they drop out of a study and loss to follow-up is always averaged in as potential toxicity in my mind. So there is some level that the total numbers matter more to me than do the individual reasons, particularly given that in the data set I gave you and told you about AEs, that was the reason they dropped out of the study, but I didn't give you the data to tell you whether they were having AEs related to hearing. Yeah. So, that was the reason they stated, but they might have been having hearing loss too. You don't know, so the quality of the data is not perfect in that regard. And that's always the case. Other questions? Have we had enough on here?
So when you take the final measurement on everybody, you were talking about we don't want to carry that forward.
I'm not viewing it as carry forward. I am not pretending to anybody that here is the results after a year of treatment. Instead, here are the results over the maximal time that they took the drug.
Okay, and this was the average time of follow-up. Yeah,
that's right, exactly. There are issues with any analysis we do, but I think that one's probably the cleanest of our choices from my standpoint. Those are the words that I would use. There are lots of ways to analyze this data that are correct. And this is the frustration of students always. And they say, but you don't tell us the right way to do it. There isn't a single right way. There are, however, lots of wrong ways. Usually, the errors that you make are describing the analysis you did wrong. Not in doing that analysis, but not correctly talking about what the limitations are. So the analysis is fine. Just make certain you know what it tells you.
So do you think it's a waste of space to talk about the baseline characteristics based of their testing of their frequency?
No, that's not at all, because that's the major predictor. You would really want to see how balanced they were, although you are going to adjust for it in some way. Mm-hmm. So it's less important, but you'd still like to see how many people are already at huge loss at the highest frequencies. I mean, that'd be the sort of thing.
By dose group. And if you find them to be comparable, would you just put that as a sentence in your...
Most people would probably want to see a variable like that. Yeah. Most people want to see the baseline, so they would make you show that, even if you said, oh, they're all comparable, and we're adjusting for it, so who cares? All of those are true, but they'd still want to see it, so... And the tables don't have to fit into your 5 pages. No. No, I'm just looking at it. I'm just holding it up to the light. And when I see anything on the baseline, I'll still also say, but it's adjusted for it. I don't care. But if you showed me that the age was markedly different, but even then I'd have to imagine why I care if it's a baseline comparable or the baseline. That's the thing. You just have to hold it up to your life. That's the best one. You can have bad confounding, which is not statistically significant.
hopefully the one fact that you left from the paper was the fact that other lives is kind of the tractor tablet on a week from Sunday. And then, frankly, any exams you have on Monday are pretty unimportant anyway. I think you almost have 5:45 for the year that day.